This is the Bible Show. Welcome, folks, to another episode of the Bible Show. My name is Sam. Joining me is Will. And we are continuing our series in the book of Genesis. Today we're getting into Genesis 29, and this is where Jacob is going to get a taste of some poetic justice, right? The deceiver is going to get deceived. Lots of stuff is going to start going upside down for him. And it is, this chapter does such an amazing job of presenting us some of the benefits of the gospel in an upside down way. But by the time we get through with this, you're going to see why it is so important to find your identity, your worth, your value in the love of God and your relationship with God. Because Jacob and Leah, his wife, both of them are going to come trying to find their identity in anything else but God. And you see just how much that brings chaos into their life and to everybody around them.
Yeah, this is a messy chapter, but to Genesis standards, it doesn't seem too messy.
Yeah.
But it is. It is, and it's very complex humanity in this one, I feel like. This one's very much one where you're like, the whole time, like, oh, everybody's feeling something.
Mm-hmm. And this is one of those chapters, this is another one of those chapters where you have something happen where you're like, that's just crazy. Like, why would God allow this? Why would he put it in the scriptures? Like, what is it that we're to learn from it? And so these are some of the questions that we need to be asking of the passage as we go through. And so just as kind of a background, when we get to Genesis 29, Jacob is now clearly in the front seat as the main character. We've moved beyond Abraham, his grandfather, Isaac, his father. And Jacob is like, it feels like the patriarchs, you know, the Bible presents them as very messy, and Jacob is going to be the messiest of them all, perhaps, but he's deceptive. His name means heel grabber, right? Well, what does that mean? Somebody who trips other people up. When you grab somebody's foot as they're running or walking, what's going to happen?
Like, they're going down.
Yeah, it's like tying somebody's shoelaces together. You're going to trip them up. So his name means somebody that causes others to stumble. And so we've seen him deceive his dad, right? We've seen him steal the birthright from his brother. We've seen him trick his brother into giving away the birthright and to steal the blessing from his father is what I meant to say. And now he's got a brother that wants to kill him, a dad who's probably pretty upset with him, a mother that's playing favorites. And so now he's on the run. Last chapter, he is on the way out, and God appeared to him with Jacob's ladder and shows him that the angels are coming up and down saying, like, hey, I'm involved in the affairs of heaven. And then for the first time, God comes to Jacob and says, I'm giving you the very same promises that I gave to Abraham and promised to Isaac. Those promises are now yours. And so just kind of setting up how this chapter is going to go, like, Jacob is, I think God is leading him out into this long journey. He's going to be gone for 20 years. He doesn't expect to be gone for 20 years, but he's going to be gone for 20 years looking for a bride. I mean, that's the main mission. And I think God is ordaining this where he's going to learn that all the different behaviors that he imposed on others, he's going to have imposed on him. And I think God is doing that to help shape his character. God is putting him on a transformational project through everything that he's going to suffer and everything that he's going to endure as he's trying to scheme and do everything on his own terms. And a lot of times that's the way God works with us.
Yeah. And there's a lot of honesty in this because he's alone this time. Mm-hmm. You know, now it's just Jacob. All of his schemes are going to just fall back on him. There's no blaming mom. There's no blaming dad. It's just going to be like, okay, this is me. And I have to understand who I am and deal with me right now.
Yeah, that's right. And remember, his parents, his dad was like, hey, I want you to go back to the place of our fathers to find a wife. And he sent him away penniless.
Yeah.
He doesn't have an entourage. He doesn't have all the camels. He doesn't have any money. And so when we get to verse 1 in chapter 29, it says, then Jacob went on his journey, and he came to the land of the people of the east. As he looked, he saw a well. Okay, so we stop right there. What already should you be looking for?
Wells happen, you know?
Wells happen. So what's coming?
A bride.
A bride. Like, this is going to be one of the patterns of the Old Testament. When you find a well, a bride is typically right on the way. So he saw a well in the field, and behold, three flocks of sheep lying beside it. For out of that well, the flocks were watered. The stone on the well's mouth was large. And when all the flocks were gathered there, the shepherds would roll the stone away from the mouth of the well and water the sheep. And then they would put the stone back in its place over the mouth of the well. So, like, right out of the gates, we see, like, it's focusing on the size of this stone. This is, you can't get water unless you can move the stone, but it requires, it's so large, it requires, like, a huge number of people to come to be able to do this. And so why do you think they would put the stone over the mouth of a well?
I mean, that's just well safety, right?
Yeah, safety. I mean, if you think about it, if this is the supply in which your villagers are going to be drinking, your flocks are going to be drinking, what do you not want getting down in there?
Anything you don't want to be drinking.
Yeah, that's right. So like a dead animal that falls down in there and can't get out and then they die, well, then all of your water is made toxic or bugs or and somebody's ability to poison it or anything like that. You know, this is safety for your community. So they would put this massive stone that required quite an ordeal to move it because otherwise anybody and everybody could just come and if the enemy of your village comes along, I'm going to throw dead carcasses in your well. You can't use it. Your water supply is gone. And so this is kind of like public safety. This is a big deal. And so in verse 4, it says, Jacob said to them, my brothers, where do you come from? And they said, we're from Haran.
Oh, he has no idea where he is.
He has no idea where he is. He just shows up to this place. He sees a well. And probably he's like, hey, I remember the story of when Eliezer met my mom for my dad. Like, it was at a well. And he's like, I wonder if this is it. So he's asking, like, where am I? Like, I see the well. And so it's from Haran. And this is great news because Haran is the place where Abraham's family comes. He's at his destination 550 miles away on this route that would have gone through the Fertile Crescent. And so verse 5, it says, he said to them, do you know Laban, the son of Nahor? And they said, we do know him. And he said to him, is it well with him? Like, is my clan still alive? Like, are they still around here? And they said, it is well. And see, oh, Rachel, his daughter, coming with the sheep. And he said, behold, it is still high day. It's not time for the livestock to be gathered together. Water your sheep and go pasture them. So, like, this is Jacob. I mean, so let me just summarize. You remember the story of the woman at the well? What's weird about her being there at noon?
No one goes there at noon.
You don't do it at noon. Like, because it's hot, you come in the early hours or the late hours to get water. But here you find all these guys that are there at midday, and Jacob's like, you're not supposed to be here. Like, just go away. I mean, that's what he's saying. He's like, you're just sitting here with a well that's covered by this stone. You're just lazy. You're not doing what a shepherd should be doing, which is letting your sheep be out there grazing. So get the stone off, get your water, and get out of here. I got Rachel coming, and I don't want you being around here messing up my game. And I think that's what's going on here, but it's hilarious to me that Jacob is calling them out on laziness.
Just coming right into town, just bossing people around.
Right?
Like, who are you, dude? Get out of here.
Right? This is Jacob, right? And he is a schemer. Like, he can take advantage and cut corners and do all that himself. And how rich is it that he's looking at these guys going, like, you're not allowed to game the system. Yeah. Get out of here. Like, you should be out shepherding your sheep. But it also shows you that he's got the instincts of a shepherd, even though he's the one that's supposed to be in the tents and Esau's the one who's the hunter. Here you see, like, he knows they're taking advantage.
The average advice of a shepherd, though, like, just go be a shepherd. It's not like he knows a lot.
but also, like, you got to remember Isaac, his dad, massive, massive flocks, right? He knows he's got the employees under Isaac Incorporated that should be taking care of the sheep. He knows people game the system. So here he is in son of the CEO mode being like, you're taking advantage of your boss. Get out of here. Yeah. Like, go shepherd your sheep. So anyway, they said, we cannot until all the flocks are gathered together and the stone is rolled away from the mouth of the well. And then we water the sheep. What do they mean by that?
And not until everyone gets here can we even move this stone. So just hold your horses.
This thing is heavy. We're not going to do this alone. We need more people to show up so we can move this stone.
Which is a great excuse. These guys have figured it out too. They're like, we all can't. Oh, we got here first. We're early. We've just got to wait for these other guys.
Bummer. All day we're just going to lounge around not doing our job. And so it says, while he was still speaking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess.
Ooh.
All right.
Is that our first shepherdess in the Bible?
It is. But there are plural. There are multiple shepherdesses. But this is a job that's typically, in the ancient world, you read sources, you look at the Bible, this is a job that typically is reserved for men. But you do find shepherdesses, and what do you find in Laban's home? Does he have a son?
No.
Maybe. Oh. I think he may. I'm not sure, but it only focuses on his daughters. And in this case, she's coming, and she's a shepherdess. Like, fast forward, and you get into the early chapters of Exodus, and when Moses is running away from Pharaoh, when he first meets Zipporah, he's running away from Pharaoh. He leaves. He goes out into the wilderness, and he comes to a well, and it's Jethro's daughters that are shepherdesses out in the Sinai wilderness where he meets them. So that you do find other shepherdesses in the Bible. But this is like what it wants you to recognize is this is providence to the extreme.
Yeah.
People don't come to the well at midday. They don't come at noon. And yet God has ordained that Rachel is going to do something abnormal to come out to this well to meet Jacob right in the middle of the day. And God is like, ta-da. I'm not just bringing you to the right place. I'm not just like, this is Laban's home. This is Laban's city. But I'm going to bring you his daughter and the most beautiful daughter right on time, right at noon, and when she's not supposed to be there. So God is clearly moving in this. Verse 10, it says, now, as soon as Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, Jacob came near and rolled the stone from the well's mouth and watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother.
What a guy.
So he sees Rachel. This is the big thing. He's an appetitive guy, right? Remember, if we go back in time when Eliezer is sent to find a bride for Isaac, do you remember when he's walking and he's like, I need to find a bride for Isaac. I'm going to come up with a test. What is the test?
If the woman comes and waters his camels.
That's right. If the woman comes and she volunteers to water the camels, and why does he want to know that? Because if she's willing to do that, then man, she is virtuous. She's hospitable. She's generous. She's humble. She's all of these things. And Eliezer wants
character,
right? What's Jacob?
He's all about looks.
This is it. Like, he has no idea what she's like, but it's like he sees her and it's like, ooh, I want that one. That's the one. Has no idea if Rachel's a psychopath or, you know, anything else. But he goes and pursues her by sight alone. And that's going to be one of Jacob's issues, is he's always impulsive. He's brilliant. He's really brilliant in the scheming, but he's always chasing like the next moment of satisfaction without thinking of the long term or his relationship with the Lord. And God is going to work with him on how to be patient.
And at least he knows
how to wait.
She's the right identity. Mm-hmm. Like, she's like, oh, I've been sent for Laban's daughters.
True.
This is at least one of them.
That's a good point, yeah. So she's going to be attractive. He's all about that. And here we see, like, this is kind of a surprising, because when you meet Jacob up until this point, like, he's described as somebody who hangs in the tents with mom, mm-hmm. while Esau's the hunter who goes out and does the big stuff. So when you're thinking Jacob, like, how do you envision him?
Tiny, fragile,
right?
Weak, I'll be honest.
And here he is. This is a stone that's so big that it requires multiple people typically to handle it. And when he sees Rachel, you know, he wants to do the feats of strength, you know. What does he do? He goes and grabs this stone all by himself and maneuvers and manipulates this thing to where he removes it from the mouth of the well himself. So Jacob is no wimp. He is no weakling. He's no, you know, frail mama's boy. Like, he is a strong guy that can do pretty amazing things. And here's something that's fascinating that we just don't see. If you go back and you look at ancient literature about what they believed in the ancient world, you know what a well symbolized? This is kind of weird.
I mean, it's life, so maybe fertility and that kind of vibe.
It's fertility, but it's actually, like, even in ancient literature, it's representative of a female anatomical body part. Okay. Yeah. So you can imagine that. Like, I don't need to describe it, okay?
We're good.
So, like, in Song of Solomon, chapter 4, verses 12 to 15, this is an allegory of two lovers, you know, singing about each other. And listen to what it says. So the man is singing about the woman. He says, you are a garden locked up, my sister, my bride. You are a spring enclosed, a sealed fountain. You are a garden fountain, a well of flowing water streaming down from Lebanon. This is very sexually charged language. And so when you come to a well. The idea of a well, like you said, is fertility. It brings life. It's the water in that that then it's used to bring life to your flocks. It brings life to your crops. It brings life to everything. That's it's the source of life for your village. If this goes away, your village dies, right? Mm-hmm. And here's Jacob that shows that he has the power, hear this, to roll away the stone to bring life to all around him, right? But there's a problem, because the Bible doesn't come to you and say that this is the hero of the story who rolls away the stone to bring life. He does this because he desperately wants to be in a relationship with Rachel, but what do we later find out about Rachel? Can she bring forth life?
She's barren.
She's barren. Here we go again with another one of the patriarchs, you know, having to struggle through barrenness. She's going to be barren, which means Jacob rolling away the stone has no power to bring life. But what does that beg in your mind? When you just hear the words, roll away the stone.
I mean, that's pointing to Jesus.
Pointing to Jesus, right? And what does his rolling away the stone do?
Gives us real life, resurrection life.
Man, it's life to the ends of the earth, everything about this. And so in a weird way, this is kind of foreshadowing something where Jesus is going to be far greater than Jacob. To prove his love for you, he rolls away the stone to bring life and fertility, eternally so. But Jacob, from this moment, you talk about love at first sight, he becomes obsessed with Rachel.
Yeah.
She's an idol. Like, she is an idol. Tim Keller says, romantic love is the most culturally acceptable form of idolatry, and it is, I think, it's definitely up there.
Yeah.
To where it's like, gosh, I love her. I'll do anything for her. I'll yield my whole life. I'll make bad decisions. I'll do whatever to win her without being wise or shrewd in how he goes about it. And he's going to pay for that in multiple ways over the next 20 years. That idolatry comes back to harm him, where if he would have loved her through a godly sense of selflessness, the story would go much differently. We'll see.
And it's funny working with middle schoolers and high schoolers, because that's so like on brand. Like, you see them just like throw their whole lives away for a couple of months of dating someone, and it's just so funny because they don't know how to hide it yet.
Yeah.
We won't see a guy for a while and be like, what happened? Like, oh, he got a girlfriend. We're like, okay, we'll see him in like 8 months. He'll circle back. But obsessive is at that age is just funny to see. And they don't hide it at all because they don't know. It's just like, okay.
Oh, I can remember teaching high school.
Yeah.
The lunch periods where they would come in and their life was just an absolute shambles because they were obsessive over, you know, a girl or a boy. And that's kind of where Jacob is. But again, it points to this appetitive, I need to conquer the next thing in front of me, and I got to figure out any way I can to scheme to get it. And it begins, it'll lead him to make some impulsive, rash decisions later in the coming chapters. Verse 11, so if it hasn't gotten weird yet, Jacob kissed Rachel and wept aloud.
I'm just trying to imagine first meeting. You're a girl. This guy moves a stone, and you're like, that was cool.
All right. Thank you
all
very much.
All of a sudden, he's kissing you and crying. You're like, what?
Yeah, this is. And by the way, this isn't like a smooch.
Okay.
So that's the way. When I first read it, I was like, okay, this guy's kind of a weirdo. Like, I mean, this is still a little weird. But like, I'm imagining him, you know, planting one on her or something. No, it like a customary greeting of that day was to like give somebody a kiss on both cheeks or something along those lines. But it's more of a familial respect. Like, you are my kin. I have traveled 500. Now, you got to imagine also, to give Jacob the benefit of the doubt, you've just spent 550 miles through some pretty rough terrain, dangerous conditions. You're hoping God is with you. You're hoping he's giving you favor. You've had sleepless nights, all the crazy stuff that I'm sure that was on that journey. You're wondering how this is going to turn out. And you show up at a well, and here she comes, and you can imagine all that angst and anxiety and wondering what's coming. And it's like all that releases at one moment. He's so happy to see family. I don't think it's just like, oh, you're beautiful, I'm smooching you and weeping. You know, but it's all of that, just like God has been faithful without saying God has been faithful. And he kisses Rachel and just weeps, which you got to imagine for her is like, whoa, dude, like this.
It's a lot.
This is a lot. This is a lot. And one of the things that you do notice, you know, I mentioned that God was faithful, brought him there. But what does Eliezer do? When he comes across family, if you remember, he immediately breaks out into
praise.
He's like, you know, the God of Abraham, you know, like he breaks out and he's like over the moon that God has been faithful in his journey. What do you not find in this story?
We don't find a lot of prayer and praise.
You don't find a lot of prayer and praise in the life of Jacob yet.
Yeah.
He is very much about, I'm going to figure this out on my own. And so verse 12, I mean, even remember last chapter when God's like, I'm going to be with you. Jacob's like, all right, well, if you bless me and you do all this stuff for me, I'll follow you.
Yeah.
All right, so verse 12, and Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's kinsman and that he was Rebekah's son. And she ran and told her father. As soon as Laban heard the news about Jacob, her sister's son, he ran to meet him and embraced him and kissed him and brought him to his house. Now, why do you think that is?
I mean, he sees money signs again.
That's right. He remembers, gosh, that guy Eliezer, you know, his dad's servant or grandfather's servant, that guy came with so much gold and 10 camels and he had so much wealth. He hears that family's in and it's time to cash in again like they cashed in with Rebekah. And he's like, he's running and comes up, kisses him. There it is again. And brought him into his house. And Jacob told Laban all these things. And Laban said to him, surely you are bone, you are my bone and my flesh. And he stayed with him a month. And now I want you to notice how that's going to pivot. Because initially, what's Laban's attitude? Family. Mm-hmm. Oh, come on in. Let me take care of you. You know, I'm long lost uncle. I'm gonna love you. You're safe here. Stay as long as you want. Like he's rolling out the red carpet. And everything's about, like, I love you just because you're family.
That's the outward.
Yeah. So Jacob may have met his match in Laban, at least initially, as a deceiver. This guy is a schemer too. And so Laban then stays with him. They stay together for a month. And then verse 15, it says, Laban said to Jacob, because you're my kinsman, should you therefore serve me for nothing? Tell me, what should your wages be? Now, this is counterintuitive, because what does it sound like he's saying?
I want to pay you. You deserve money for this.
I don't want to take advantage of you.
You're generous.
You're family. Like, let me pay you. Whatever your wages need to be, I'll pay them. Now, that sounds like he's, oh, this guy's amazing. Like, good uncle. You know, it's not like you're just recruiting, you know, free labor from family. You want to pay. But what's behind this is Laban's not being generous. He wants control. Mm. If you come in my house and I say, man, you're my brother in Christ. I'm going to take care of you. Now, all of that is completely voluntary and free, right?
Yeah, like it's walk away whenever.
That's right. But the moment I say, no, let me pay you. Mm. What happens now?
Employer-employee relationship begins.
That's right. And that changes all the dynamic. Now I can tell you what to do. Now I can heap expectations on you. And it's like, you know, and it would be like adding legalism to the relationship to where it's no longer free. This isn't enjoyable. It's not, hey, we're equals. We're the same. We're in a covenant of grace and love. Now it's, hey, I'm paying you. You owe me stuff.
Yeah.
And I can make demands of you. And so all of a sudden, everything is about to shift and into that employee-employer mode. That's exactly what Laban wants. He wants to bind him with a contract. This is not altruism here. And so now Laban had two daughters, verse 16. The name of the older was Leah. So this first time we meet Leah. And the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah's eyes were weak, and Rachel was beautiful in form and appearance. Now, this is one of the most, like, people quibble about what this means. Leah's eyes were weak, but Rachel was beautiful in form. If you didn't know what that meant, what would you assume? If it says Leah's eyes were weak, but
yeah,
Rachel was beautiful in form.
Putting Rachel's beauty as the opposite of whatever Leah was.
That's right. So Leah is not beautiful, right? At least not in the eyes of people. Like, Jacob looks at Rachel and it's like, whew, man, like, I want her as my wife, but Leah's eyes were weak. And so there's all kinds of conjecture over what that means, but the Hebrew word for weak literally means soft or gentle. And it's like some people say maybe she had an eye condition or she was cross-eyed or, you know, she couldn't see well. I mean, there's all kinds of theories, but I think the answer is much simpler than people make it. And because Leah's name, remember in the Bible, names tend to be prophetic, right?
Yeah.
Leah's name means weary. Leah's name literally means exhausted. Like when we named our daughter Leah, it was like, oh, here's another name.
Why do you guys do this?
Another name. We have a Jacob who's, you know, supplanter, a Leah who's exhausted. Anyway, I think if it means soft and gentle, how do you, if this is soft and gentle under here, like I think it's referring to bags under the eyes. I think she looks absolutely worn out. And if you're coming across, you know, somebody that's an addict, somebody that's worn out in life, somebody that has just been absolutely strung through the mud, where's the first place it shows up?
The eyes.
The eyes. And I think when they show up, it's like you look at Leah and, man, she looks like she has been really damaged by life. She looks worn out. Her name means exhausted. But Rachel's vibrant. You know, she's got lots of life, you know, beautiful eyes, everything else. Leah looks worn and tired and exhausted and unattractive for that reason. And so God is setting up this contrast with Leah and Rachel. And as you get to learn the story of Leah, you're going to find out why she is so exhausted. And it's so instructive for us. But for this sake, you have Leah the older, Rachel the younger. Which one does Jacob want?
The younger.
Right?
Rachel.
So keep this dynamic in mind. You have an older sibling and a younger sibling. Jacob wants the younger to be the chosen. Is there a backstory going on there? Because remember where he's coming from?
Jacob and Esau. Yeah, he's the younger. He wants to supplant the older, and he wants to just flip everything.
That's right. And so now he's coming, and he wants the younger at the expense of the older, except God, I think, is going to teach him a lesson here. And so in verse 18, it says, Jacob loved Rachel, and he said, I will serve you for 7 years for your younger daughter, Rachel. Like, so this is Laban's, this is a dream. Like before, I was having to take care of you with just pure generosity and getting nothing in return. But now that I've been like, hey, your family, you know, I should be paying you. Now Jacob's like, I will work 7 years for you to get Rachel. And like,
why does Jacob lead with that? Do we know? Like, how did he come to that conclusion? Is seven, like, is this normal?
Well, seven is the number of perfection in the Bible, which, so I think there's some of that, like, but also I think Jacob is throwing down an offer because he is so crazy, you know, ridiculously in love with Rachel that he offers an absurd thing.
Yeah, 7 years is crazy.
7 years. So like, I did the math on this. I went back and did all kinds of research into cultural, you know, what would have been at the time. Jacob could have gone out into the market back then and gotten 250 shekels for 7 years of labor as an average worker, right? Okay. So 250 shekels of silver for 7 years of labor. The typical bride price in that day, we find this in Deuteronomy 22, verse 29. The typical bride price is 50 shekels. So Jacob shows up and says, I'll give you five times the asking price for Rachel, 7 years. Normally, I'd probably just have to work a year and a half or something like that. I'll give you 7 years if you guarantee me Rachel at the end. Don't give her to anyone else. My dad sent me here with no money. I got nothing else to offer. The only thing I can give you is my labor, but I want her. I'll give you 7 years, which is a crazy offer. And he knows Laban's going to be like,
jump on it, yeah.
Of course. Absolutely. This is an incredible deal for me. And so, and he knows Laban's greedy, so he knows he won't turn it down. And getting back to your, you know, middle school, high school boy, you know, appetitive thing, like he's offering crazy stuff here. And so Jacob specifies, by the way, notice this, that he wants, and he says it out loud, for your younger daughter, Rachel. He's made it very clear who he wants and who he is not interested in, right? I don't care that she's the younger one and that there's an older one that's unmarried. I want the younger daughter, Rachel. And Laban said, it's better that I give her to you than I should give her to any other man. So stay with me. So Jacob's like, all right, deal. I got a deal. And so Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed to him but a few days because of the love he had for her. And that's, gosh, that's one of the most profound statements in this whole story. He worked 7 years, but they seemed like a few days because of the love he had for her.
He actually loves her.
Yeah, but think, how do you apply that to your life?
I don't know, that
working
whole,
7 years and it feels like days.
That the whole adage, if you love what you do, you never work a day in your life.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely on that street.
That same vein, yeah.
But think about this. What it's saying, what the Bible is communicating to you is if you know that the reward of your labors, the reward of your investment, the reward of your sufferings, whatever, is going to be so worth it, what does it do to all your sufferings in the present?
They're meaningless.
It's like a few days.
Yeah.
You know, I remember reading somebody saying, you know, if you went to Giant Stadium and somebody said, I want you to clean every toilet and urinal in this whole place and I'll pay you minimum wage, you would go through all of those bathrooms going, what have I done with my life? Mm. Like, oh, this is terrible. Oh, my goodness, look at that. Oh, why don't people flush? Like, you would go through it complaining the whole way. But if they said to you, hey, I'm going to pay you $1 billion.
Clean every toilet twice.
I'd be like, seriously? You're going to give me that for this?
That'd be spotless bathroom.
Right? Like, and you would go through it without a complaint in the world. It would be like, you know, of course it's not pleasant, but man, the reward makes everything worth it. So how do you apply that? How does the Christian take this wisdom and apply it to our day? Because we all have suffering. We all have these things that are unpleasant. We all have, you know, crosses to bear that we're required to go through life. How can we bear those crosses? It's not by looking at the circumstances going, why am I not enjoying this cross? Like, this cross should be enjoyable. This is fun to carry a means of suffering. Like, no, that is not the way the Bible communicates this to you. Mm-hmm. The suffering's not fun. The Bible doesn't come and try to, like, you know, Jedi mind trick you and go, oh, no, you really are enjoying the suffering, right? Like, no, that's not what it's about. What the Bible comes to you with is a promise that the reward that is stored up for you in heaven, that is purchased by Christ, that you inherit, is so absolutely fantastic, amazing, beyond what you deserve or could even ask or imagine, that you can then walk through the present sufferings knowing what's in store. And all of this suffering is what Paul calls light and momentary affliction in comparison. This is Romans 8. All these present sufferings are not worthy to be compared to the glory that's going to be revealed in us. How can Paul walk through a life with way more suffering than me? Where's his eyes fixed?
Eternity.
Down the road. So Jacob is like, in 7 years I get her. So all of those 7 years of suffering and toil and work and everything else are like, light and momentary.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah, I heard a phrase recently that was, we plan for the future just short of eternity. I thought, oh, that is true. Yeah. Like I plan for all of these future things, and then like eternity, like that's way out there. Like when you look at it like this, it's like, oh, that's the fuel that keeps this whole thing going.
Mm-hmm. And that's it. Like it's borrowing. It's something that our pastor Tom says, you have to borrow from tomorrow. You have to borrow hope from tomorrow and apply it to the sufferings of today. It's the way that you get through it. This is the secret sauce of the Christian faith, is knowing what's coming. It makes everything present worth it. I can endure today because I have hope for tomorrow.
And we're in an interesting time because we get to look back on the cross and forward to glory, whereas these people are still looking forward to the cross, so they don't even have that, you know, like objective reality in their life that we do.
Yeah, and it's precisely that gives us confidence, right? Like if God, and the Bible comes to us with this logic, if God would not spare his own son, you can look back and see the measure of his love. That should give you confidence in the promises of what's to come.
Yeah.
Like I remember having this conversation with middle schoolers way back in the day where it's like, okay, if God, because he wants a bride suitable for his son, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's not just going to settle on a dog. But if God wants a bride that's suitable for his son, and he's willing to lay down his life on a cross and suffering and be spat upon and mocked and everything else to purchase that bride, that means that bride has to be deemed worthy of that suffering, which means what in the world is God going to have to do to us and with us to make us worthy of God on a cross? Do you know that someday you're going to be worth that to him? Like you are right now, but what he's purchasing to glory, you're going to be worth that price tag somehow. Like, I mean, it's wild to think about, but that's what's in store for us. You will be made into his image. You're going to be transformed from one degree of glory to the next. That is your future. With every day getting better and better and more of a reflection of his glory and his peace and his love, like heaven is going to be amazing, which then makes this season of labor like, okay, this is light and momentary and light of eternity. you know, what do I get, 80 years? What is 80 years in comparison to an infinite number of amount of time?
Yeah.
Okay, but, like, I can deal with this.
Yeah, even I was thinking about this verse in Ephesians 1:18, and, you know, and Paul's, you know, he's praying, he's doing spiritual blessings. He says, having the eyes of your hearts enlightened, that you may know what is the hope to which he called you, what are the riches of his, being Jesus' glorious inheritance in the saints.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy that Jesus is looking at us like, you guys are the inheritance I want in the end.
Yeah, that's pretty wild.
It's like, are you sure about that?
Think about how many times the Bible calls us his treasured possession.
Yeah, it's like...
Like, of everything, it's like he looks at us and goes, that's my treasure right there. They are. And when you think, like, we talk about Jacob being impulsive for work, for just 7 years. I'll do 7 years, you know, five times the bride price that I would otherwise have to pay. Think about the bride price that God was willing to pay for us. Mm. Like, we called Jacob, like, whoa, 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 that's too much.
Yeah, he seems reckless.
That's, yeah, it does, right? But then God comes and says, I'll give absolutely everything, even my life, for them. That's how valuable you are in the sight of God. So when we think of how, you know, enthralled Jacob is from an appetitive, foolish sense, right? God, from a perfectly wise, beautiful, sovereign sense, looks at you and says, I'll give more. You won't be able to outbid me in what I'll pay for my people. Mm. Like, that's God's heart for his people. That's just insane how much he loves us. I mean, not insane. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's wild to ponder how much he loves us. And so, and the back to Genesis, verse 21, then Jacob said to Laban, give me my wife that I may go in to her, which is like, all right. Can you imagine being a dad and somebody says that to you?
Honestly, no.
Like, anyway.
No, don't. Keep going.
Golly. Give me my wife that I may go in to her. I think that's colloquial at the time, maybe. For my time is completed. And so, like, you know, this relationship, mutual affection, been burning for 7 years. We've been holding off. Like, it's time. Let's go.
And that's the funny part about scripture, because we were talking about kisses.
Yeah.
Like, it says kiss. And, like, no, the Bible uses way different language for sexual things.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Know her, go into it. It's like that kind of stuff. So don't worry about the word kiss.
Yeah, yeah, definitely not. So verse 22, so Laban gathered together all the people of the place and made a feast. Now, one of the things that's interesting, this word for feast in the Hebrew mitzvah is almost always talking about, like, this is a drunken kind of a feast. The alcohol is flowing. The root of that word even has, like, the meaning to drink. So, like, I'll give you a couple of other examples. In Isaiah 25:6, it says a feast of well-aged wine. Like, when we think feast, you don't think liquid, right?
I think purely food.
Yeah, a feast of well-aged wine. Or Jeremiah 51:39, prepare them a feast and make them drunk. So, like, it's very clearly...
Jeremiah says that?
That's yeah. Wild. Well, I mean, it's not God being like, yeah, you do this. But the feast is associated with drunkenness, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what's Laban doing here? Because this is going to be something that's, like, crazy to believe how he pulls this off, but he knows he has to get Jacob plowed for this feast.
Yeah.
Jacob's senses. Remember what he tried to do to his father, Isaac, when he was trying to fool his father?
Yeah, trick his senses.
Got to trick the senses. What's a way to make your senses unreliable?
Alcohol will do that.
Alcohol will do that. Yeah, put on the beer goggles and everything else. Like, everything is going to be thrown off here. So he's like, I'm going to throw a feast. We're going to get Jacob absolutely plowed. And this is where he goes. It says, he gathered all of his people of the place and made a feast. But in the evening, he took his daughter Leah and brought her to Jacob. And he went into her. So what has he just done here?
Consummated the marriage with Leah.
He's consummated the marriage with Leah. But in addition to that, he's pulled a Jacob.
Yeah.
He said, now, but I know you want this one of the children. I'm going to sneak in this one and make you enter into a covenant arrangement with them. Why is that familiar? That's exactly what Jacob did to his father. You know, deceive all the senses and put himself out there to get the blessing instead of the one that the father intended it for. And now here you have Jacob, who intends to enter into a covenant with Rachel, but here you have the father who's like, nope, I'm putting the older one in place of the younger one. And now Jacob has entered into a covenant with someone he didn't intend to enter into a covenant with.
Because his senses can't tell the difference.
That's right. And so now Jacob is left with this situation where it's like, if you're Jacob and you, let's just keep going here. So he brought Leah to Jacob, and he went into her. Laban gave his female servant Zilpah to his daughter Leah to be her servant. And in the morning, behold, it was Leah. And Jacob said to Laban, "What is this that you've done to me? Did I not serve with you for Rachel? Why then have you deceived me? And if you're Jacob, why are you not like, marriage annulled? Like, that's not what I'm doing. Like, tough. You know, you gave me Leah, but tough. That's not what the deal was. I want Rachel. You can keep Leah. I'm done with her."
He just can't do that.
Why not?
Just like Isaac couldn't just take back the blessing. Just like, oh, I made a mistake.
In the ancient world, when you entered into divine covenant, it was irrevocable. Mm. So to hand down a blessing, to hand down a divine proclamation, a marriage, like, it was seen as irrevocable. And beyond that, Jacob has to be thinking, well, if I say this covenant is no good because you deceived me, what's the implication?
I don't have a blessing either.
Then I don't have a blessing because I got that through deceit. And so God is coming to Jacob being like, you see?
How does this feel?
Like he's trying to form his soul. And God doesn't condone what Laban's doing, obviously, but God will use the consequences of it, you know? And Jacob is going to be formed by these things, right? So in the morning, behold, it was Leah, and Jacob said to Laban, "What is this you've done to me?" It's the same reaction, this shock and horror that Isaac and Esau felt. And so here all of a sudden, Jacob is furious over this obligation to marry Leah. He's going to despise her for quite a long time. And this is where, like, I want to pause because we don't tend to think this story through from the perspective of Leah.
Yeah, because it's sad.
Like, let's walk through. She's the older daughter, but nobody's coming for her. We're told that she's, you know, she's weak eyes, whatever that means. She looks haggard. She looks exhausted. She's not attractive. Everybody's always complimenting Rachel. Rachel, look at her. She's always the ignored one. No suitor is coming. And think about this. Your dad sees you as so inferior to your sister that he comes to you and says, "We're going to have to get this guy drunk to take you."
And your dad is so desperate for your lack of options of marrying you off.
Yeah.
So you'll be his responsibility for the rest of his life that he's like, "I got to get rid of her somehow."
We're going to have to scheme to find someone who will be willing to love you. Like, it's going to take desperate measures of deceit and crazy scheme.
And I guess we don't
to
know.
Get anyone to love you.
I guess we don't hear much from her, but it does, you know, like when Rachel was scheming with Jacob, Jacob seemed in on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's like, "Okay, yeah, let's go steal some birthrights and steal a blessing here." But Leah almost feels like not a participant.
Yeah. It's where Jacob is like aggressively deceitful. Leah, you can see, is just a crushed person.
She's just a pawn in all this.
And you think about your marriage night as your husband is coming to you to consummate the marriage, and you have to pretend that you're someone else for your first time.
Yeah.
Because you're entirely unlovable and everybody knows it.
And you know the plot has to unravel. Yeah, it's not like we can fake this for the rest of our lives.
Yeah.
Like light's going to dawn in the morning.
Yeah, you know this is going to lead to a life, if he honors his covenant, this is going to lead to a life where you're resented.
Mm.
But anything to have a chance at love. I mean, it's just, when you work that through for her, like she becomes this incredible, even though she's deceitful and it's like, "Leah, what are you doing?" She feels like she has no other choice. Jacob feels like he has no other choice but to scheme. She feels like she has no other choice but to scheme. Him through ambition, her through desperation. And it's like, I have to do this. Yeah. I have to, if I'm going to find love, I have to scheme. And the reality is, like, Jacob is learning in this situation. By the way, they're the perfect couple. You know, like, both of them have schemed to get their positions in life. Like, that. This is who they are.
And how much could she have said no to Laban in this regard?
Probably back then. It's
like the authoritative father saying, "Hey, this is the plan."
Yeah, it would have been hard to say no to a father in that culture, for sure. But it just, she's a tragic figure to this point.
Mm-hmm.
And God is coming to Jacob. I think, you know, like the Bible says, God is not mocked, for whatever one sows, so shall he reap. Like, this is Jacob that has done all this deceiving that's finally met someone who's giving him a taste of his own medicine.
Mm.
And now he's having to go, "Oof, like I gotta honor this." But it also shows like the dangers of favoritism that bring so much pain in the Bible, like where Laban very clearly favors Rachel to the point where he'll do this to his own daughter. You have, you know, Isaac showing favoritism to Esau that sends Jacob and all his insecurity to scheme and strive and do all that, refusing to give the blessing to Jacob as God had told Rebekah. Or Jake, you're going to see Jacob with his kids who's going to play favorites. And every time it just brings this crazy destruction, and you shouldn't do it, especially with your kids. And you shouldn't have wives to play favorites with. But, you know, for polygamous cultures out there, don't, you know.
If you're tuning in.
Don't show favorites. All right, so Genesis 29, verse 26, 27. Laban said, well, it's not done so in our country to give the younger before the firstborn. To which you want to reply what? Like, this would have been nice to know when I told you that I wanted the younger daughter,
7 years
Rachel,
ago.
And worked for 7 years. Now, all of a sudden, Laban's like, oh, yeah, I forgot to tell you. Like, in our culture, we marry the older one first. Sorry. Complete the week of this one. So what that means is, in the ancient world, even going up into the days of Jesus, like a wedding was like a week-long festival, feast, party. So he's like, complete the week of your wedding for this one, and we'll give you the other also in returning for serving me another 7 years. So you got Leah. You don't want her. You don't like her even.
But you got to fake this week's celebration.
Fake this week's celebration. After this, you can have Rachel, but you're going to work for me for another 7 years, which essentially in the Bible is slavery. This is actually the indentured servitude that we get later, but in biblical terms, this is your slave in my house. It's pretty wild. And so the law, he's not wrong. Like the ancient legal texts, the newsy tablets talk about how you are to marry off your elder daughter first. And he's using, well, our culture says this, so we've got to do the wrong thing. And like we do that all the time. Like because we live in a particular culture, we tend to excuse sins that are not okay. Like you think about consumerism and greed and all the stuff that come in our culture where it's like we're incredibly wealthy by worldly standards, but we justify it. We're not that bad. Or divorce is just commonplace. The Bible says God hates it, but it's kind of normalized in our culture, so we're good with it. Sexual ethics, we're like, you know, you look at the rates of cohabitation and premarital sex and all that stuff. Like we make excuses for it, or even like extreme degrees of patriotism where you care more about the politics of this country than the evangelism and the expansion of God's kingdom and what he has to say. Like we do all of these things and we misprioritize things to where we introduce some messy stuff. And that's Laban's using his culture as an excuse to be wicked, frankly. And so Jacob did so. And he completed her week, and then Laban gave him his daughter Rachel to be his wife. Laban gave his female servant Bilhah to his daughter Rachel to be her servant. So Jacob went into Rachel also, and he loved Rachel more than Leah, understatement. And he served Laban for another 7 years.
Okay, so at least this time he gets Rachel and then has to serve the 7 years.
That's right.
In his mind, at least.
Yeah, he's a week, now he's got two wives, but he now has to work another 7 years, which
literal
now,
sister wives.
Now those 7 years, now so you the first 7 years you spent working and it was like a few days because of Rachel's coming. What do you think he's thinking for the entire next 7 years? It's not this is easy because I love Rachel. It's this is really miserable and I despise Leah for making me do this. Like it has the inverse effect. It is going to make him realize like this whole deceiving business, like this hurt. This had real consequences for me. And Leah is only going to get bitterness from Jacob. In fact, I think in the next chapter or next verse, it says, when the Lord saw that Leah was hated, there's that word again, like cut off.
The scripture confirms our suspicions.
Yeah. He despises her for what she's done. But the Lord saw that Leah was hated and basically had always been hated. And he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. So this is the question, like, why? Why does God do this? Is this a good thing?
I mean, it's definitely good for Leah. I mean, it gives her security. I mean, for a woman, like, for God to open your womb, it's like the first time that someone's seen. She has to be taken seriously now. Mm-hmm. as the wife who's producing children, which every family needs.
There's something weird about this that for the moralist, this is really difficult to swallow. Because like, how does Jacob come about, you know, in the story, achieving the blessing? He does it through deceit, and then God honors, and it's like, yep, you're my guy. Abrahamic blessing coming to you. All the nations on earth are going to be blessed through you, Jacob. Without discipline, without saying, hey, you lied, like, you're off the team, you're not my guy. Here you have Leah that's just engaged in deceit, and you have God coming and saying, you're mine. Like, I'm going to show favor on you because of the pain that you've walked through. Like, he sees beyond her failure, her shame, and he just sees how alone and hated she is, and he shows compassion on her. Like, that's wild. You go through the Bible, how rare is it that God says, I'm choosing the older sibling over the younger? Like, that's a theme of the Bible. It doesn't happen very often at all. Like, God is always the underdog, but in this case, who's the underdog?
Leah.
The older is the underdog. The younger has all the advantages, and so all of a sudden that shifts God's love, right? That shifts God's favor to the older, which means how is God's favor determined? He comes after the poor in spirit, just like Jesus says. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn. They will be comforted. It's the ones that recognize their great need. It's the ones who do feel far off and left out. That's the one that God's like, that's my person. God draws... One of my favorite Psalm verses, Psalm 34, verse 18. God draws near to the brokenhearted and those crushed in spirit. First Corinthians 1:27-29. God chose what is foolish, what is weak, what is low and despised. That's Leah, right? That's who he is. And so, like, the way to God is not by puffing yourself up and being like, I've got it together. God, you're lucky to have me on your team. It's recognizing your need. It's recognizing I can't scheme for it. It's his to give. And he loves me. It's powerful. Yeah, and his power is made perfect in your weakness.
And this situation is even more confusing because Rachel technically hasn't done anything wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It's not her fault that she's pretty. It's not her fault that the town maybe favors her or that her dad favors her, whatever it is. So you do feel... Also, I mean, more and more you start to feel bad for her because you're just like, man, she's kind of just along for the journey too. We haven't seen her act deceptively yet.
And this is we don't know the behind the scenes story, but this is one of those things like the Bible talks about, may the mountains be brought low and the valleys brought up. Like, God has a way of dealing with people to bring the best out of them. So like a Joseph who does nothing wrong apart from like gloating to his brothers. He's sold off into slavery in Egypt. His death is faked, but that was absolutely necessary for him to become the godly man that God needed him to be, because before that he was too arrogant, too puffed up. Yeah. And so God brought suffering to him to bring him low. He's going to bring suffering to Jacob to bring him low, and he brings favor and kindness to Leah, who's already at the bottom of the valley, to bring her up, because it's going to be the best for them. And I think Rachel, who's probably had the easy life, like this, and this sounds cold and harsh, and I don't know the mind of God, but it makes me wonder, like, is God doing this because she needs some of that to become the more beautiful person that he desires her to be, and not, look at me, I'm amazing, and everything comes easy to me, and you should all bow down, and Leah, you know, you're gross, and I'm the favored sister. Maybe she needs this. Maybe this is going to be exactly what God has for her. We don't know. But then, for the first time, you get some insight into Leah's character out of her own mouth. And this is how the chapter ends, and it's so rich and so beautiful. So Genesis 29, verse 32, and Leah conceived and bore a son, and she called his name Reuben. For she said, because the Lord has looked upon my affliction, for now my husband will love me. And Reuben, the Hebrew there, is see, sight, vision, look. And so he's like, all right, God has seen me. Maybe now my husband will love me. And what's the craziest part of the story is, who is the only person in this whole chapter that is unloved? Trick question.
That's, I have no idea.
God. You ever think about that?
Yeah, because God loves Leah. Well, God loves them all, technically.
God loves them all. He's
Leah's feeling God's love.
So here you have God who's like, oh, Leah, let me wrap you up. Let me show you favor. Let me show you that the God of the universe, the only opinion that truly matters in the law and the scheme of things, like, I'm going to love you. I'm going to open up your womb. I'm going to see you. And she's like, oh, you do see me. Maybe now my husband will love me.
Yeah, like, I don't care about your sight.
That's exactly what's going on here. Like, the one that's the most rejected in this chapter is God. So God is like, oh, let me show you how much I love you. I'm going to pour out favor. I'm going to give you a blessing. And we get the blessing. And it's like, maybe this will help me chase my idol. Like, do we do that in life? How often do we do that in life?
Like, more than I want to admit.
Good night. Like, God just blesses you. And you're like, oh, maybe I can use this blessing to chase this rather than being like, you're so good. Like, this is enough. Yeah. You're enough. Like, I just love you for how good you are, God. Thank you for seeing me. Thank you for giving me my identity. Thank you for giving me value and a hope and a future. No. We take that blessing and then we obsess over what we don't have. And it's like, maybe I can use this to get that. That's what Leah's doing. Thanks, God. Maybe Jacob will love me now. Hmm. Not, you're enough, God. Thank you for seeing me.
Yeah.
Okay, so the next one, right? So she has Reuben because God looked upon her affliction. Maybe now my husband will love me. Verse 33, she conceived again and bore a son and said, because the Lord has heard, so he's seen me, now he has heard me that I'm hated. He's given me this son also, and she called his name Simeon. So buried in that is, he's heard that I'm hated, so he's given me a son. What is she not? She's not overwhelmed by his love again. It's like, man, I'm hated. Maybe now.
Yeah.
Maybe now he'll love me. You know, thanks, God, you hear me. Maybe now he'll love me. Next one. Again, she conceived and bore a son and said, now this time my husband will be attached to me. So that's the name Levi comes from, attached. Now this time my husband will be attached to me because I've borne him three sons. Therefore, his name was called Levi. And here you see Leah, who's like, hey, God, you see me. Not enough. I want him. You hear me. Not enough. I want him. God, you're attached to me, but I want him to be attached to me. Where's she looking for her identity?
Jacob's love.
The same place she's been looking, like, and Jacob and her dad and anyone else that everybody has always overlooked her. And she has walked through life absolutely devastated. Everything about her life is empty and hollow because she's looking for her heart to be filled and to be satisfied by the opinions of everyone else around her. And she never gets it. Hmm. At least not yet.
And time is happening in this. Like, the Bible's hitting, you know, child after child after child. You know, we're only in a paragraph, but, you know, this is years, you know, 10 months per kid. You're at least 2.5 years of being pregnant plus time in between. So you're like, oh, this is a long journey she's on.
Still. And there's just bitterness flowing towards you as you're a mom of three. Hmm. And so, Jenna, you get to the climax of this chapter that is just, it just makes me want to, like, fist pump. I love this. Verse 35, she conceived again and bore a son. And what are you waiting for?
Some name that's like, thanks, God. Will my husband finally love me?
Mm-hmm.
But this time she says, this time I will praise the Lord. Therefore, she called his name Judah, and she ceased bearing. Now, if you know how the rest of Scripture goes, this is phenomenal.
Yeah.
Because what's going on here is she's empty. Jake won't love me no matter what I do, no matter how much I strive. Like, I think the reason why she's prophetically named Leah is she's exhausted. Why is she exhausted? She's chasing after everything and anything that might fill her for a moment. She's worn out chasing after things. Maybe now, maybe this time, maybe this, maybe that. And nothing ever works. And finally, she says, this time I will praise the Lord. The word praise, Judah. And she names her son Judah. And what do we know about the rest of the story? Who's this kid? This is the line. Yeah. This is where salvation will come into the world. The fourth born of Jacob, Judah. This is going to be the one that brings about the line that will lead to the salvation of the world. And it's like, this woman who is in so much pain, who can't see what God is doing behind the scenes, the moment she says, you know what, I'm not going to try to find my identity and whether what this person thinks or that person thinks or what my husband thinks of me, this time, you know what, I'm going to take the blessing and I'm going to give the praise and the love to the one who deserves it. This time I will praise the Lord. And she names him Judah, and salvation comes to the world when Leah offers up praise. What is Jesus called? Revelation 5:5. He is the Lion of the tribe of Judah. So here you have this moment where it's like, you know what? Like, I'm not chasing it anymore. God, I love you. Boom, salvation comes into the world. And there's something about that to us. Like, you go through stressful seasons, you walk through seasons that are really hard, you can sit and be like, how am I going to solve this? What do I need to do? How do I fix this? How do I fix this on my own scheming? And what will it do to your heart through that whole season when you do that?
Just destroys it.
It'll destroy you. What happens when you say, you know what, I've got a duty to do, but I'm going to give this over to God. I'm going to trust him with it. I'm going to worship him in the middle of the tears. What does that do to your heart?
It lifts it.
It frees it. It's like, I trust God with the results. I trust what he's going to do. I can remember a couple of things that jumped in my mind when I was preparing this. One was when I got a phone call when I was actually teaching high school. And the phone call was, your mom has had a heart attack. Like, they don't know if she's alive or not, but she was rushed into the ER. They don't think she's going to make it. And I get in a car and I'm flying 2 hours north. Like, I mean, breaking laws. And the whole way, like, I'm sobbing and thinking, like, am I going to get to say goodbye to her? Am I going to get to say goodbye to her? And at some point, maybe 30 minutes in, like, I'm having a hard time driving because tears are obscuring vision. But I remember saying, like, God, you love her more than me, and I trust you with her. You're good. And it was one of the most wonderful worship experiences I've ever had, where in the middle of such trauma and grief, it was transformed into, like, peace. In the middle of that, like, I trust you. If you take her home, you love her more than I do. I'm good with this.
Peace.
And she lived for a while longer. The other illustration was a pity party where I was going through a really dark season of betrayal and heartache, and just ministry was incredibly hard. And I remember walking through the Daniel Boone forest, and I was listening to psalms sung to music, like, kind of modern, which some of them are good. And I came across Psalm 16, and the lyrics of that just crushed me. Like, and it says this, Lord, you have assigned me my portion and my cup. Like, what I have is from you. You've made my lot secure. The boundary lines have fallen for me in pleasant places, and surely I have a delightful inheritance. Mm-hmm. And walking around in the middle of the Daniel Boone Forest in Kentucky, I had this moment where, after months of walking through the hardest ministry that I've ever had in my life, God reminded me, he set my boundaries in pleasant places. He's given me a family and kids that are amazing, and surrounded me with friends, and I have so much to be grateful for. This lot, this portion, has come from him, and I know he's good, and I know he's going to use it. And I can look at my life, and I could say, like, 96% of it is just solid gold or platinum, and I got 4% that aren't, it's not that great. And where do I live focused? I live focused on the 4%. And it's like, God, okay, if you give me more blessing, maybe I can get this 4% figured out. And I'm totally ungrateful and lacking worship for all the ways that he has abundantly blessed me, not to mention what he talks about in this verse. Like, I have a delightful inheritance, an eternal one, an infinite one, an unmatchable one. Why am I trying to earn the approval of this fallen, broken world when I have the delight of God? It's crazy.
Yeah, which is fascinating. Like, all throughout the Psalms, David's like commanding his soul to praise, like commanding his soul to sing. Like, he's like, I'm experiencing things that don't naturally lead me to praise. I'm in the midst of it. I'm in suffering. The enemies are encamped around me all these times. And, you know, he's facing real stuff. And what does he turn to? He's like, oh, this is not the outpouring of natural praise from my soul, but I know that praise leads me to a place where I remember who God is and who I am. And so I command my soul to praise.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's what we got to do.
Mm-hmm. And when that happens, salvation pours into the world.
Yes.
I shared something with the pastors of our church that I thought was just a clever statement. I don't know who said it. But it said, imagine seeking validation from a world that crucified a perfect man. Like, you're not going to get it. Yeah. You could be perfect, and they crucified the perfect man. But you have a God out there who looks at you and all of your flaws and would die for you.
Yes.
Where do you run to for your validation?
Yes.
The world is not worth it. Like, you're not going to get it. Go to the Lord. Let him love you. He sees you. He hears you. He attaches himself to you forever. And that's, I think, the beautiful part of what he's done for Leah this far in the story.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it is. So anyway, we're going to stop there. I want to thank you so much for watching. Join us next time as we go into the 30th chapter of Genesis and some really crazy stuff in that chapter. But we'll see you then. Thanks for listening to The Bible Show. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to like and subscribe and leave a kind review to help us in the world of tech algorithms. Also, feel free to share with a friend. We'll see you next week with another episode of The Bible Show.